Okay, let's call the Land Use Committee to order. Sorry about that, I wasn't paying attention to who had come in the room. We've got two of our colleagues waiting anxiously to testify on House Bill 2820. So let me open a public hearing on House Bill 2820A and ask our two esteemed colleagues to come to the... My daughter was here and she was playing on the iPad.
That's why I keep hearing birds.
Sorry. Spring break and kids are sometimes with their parents today, and mine was on my iPad, and he's hearing birds chirping, so welcome.
Mr. Chair, I hear birds all the time. It's incurable. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jules Bailey. I have the honor of representing House District 42. Pleased to be here with my good colleague, Representative Bentz, who will, I think, do an excellent job of explaining some of the practical dynamics around this bill. I want to simply give you a little bit of the history of how you this bill came to your committee and advocate for a couple of positions within the bill. This bill is the result of several sessions of discussion. In the last legislative session, and I believe the session before that, we had discussions about how do we best streamline the process so that we can begin siting large-scale, viable, commercially viable, economically viable renewable energy facilities like solar facilities on land, the kind of land that Representative Bent sees a lot of in his district. We convened a work group after the 2011 session. That process led to recommendations to the 2012 legislative session. We were unable to move the chains on this process in the 2012 legislative session. Had yet another series of discussions after 2012 and came back with a concept in 2013. That bill was flawed, and the relating to clause was too restrictive, so we ditched that bill and had to come back with a different bill that had a whole new concept in it, and that's the bill that you have before you now. So the long and fun route of House Bill 2820. That said, the net result of those conversations, I think, is a good concept that's before you today. It still probably needs a little bit more discussion, and hence the referral to the Land Use Committee. But what I want to convey is that in the House Energy and Environment Committee, where we focused a lot of our effort was what are the energy needs for the state of Oregon and what is most viable for an energy project in terms of its size and scale and how it's sited on especially non-arable land. And what we determined was, and the recommendation in this bill is that 640 acres, or one section, is appropriately sized to be able to create the kind of economies of scale that some of these large projects need in order to be viable. And as we see the price of solar declining, as we see more and more interest in large-scale projects that provide low-cost, commercially viable power, that having 640 acres, having an ability to have streamlined siting on non-arable land is really important to the industry and to energy and to job creation in Oregon. I understand that there are still some outstanding questions about definitions of land types. There are still a few outstanding questions about some of the land use details here. Hence, I'm very happy that your committee will be taking up such issues and that we don't have to over in House Energy and Environment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
So, but I simply want to say this is an important bill. It needs to move forward. There are projects waiting to happen. The industry needs certainty, and we believe that large-scale projects are viable, are good for Oregon, and create jobs. And with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and Cliff Bentz, District 60. And I'm handed you, or you should be looking at, a couple of pictures to try to give some sense of the scale of Oregon to those of you that are from this part of the state. And you can see our first picture is to show that my district is bigger than the state of West Virginia. And then the second chart is to show the size of my district as compared to, I'm just showing the audience.
I know what you're doing.
district, which is 8 square miles and minus 29,000. And there's only to call out that his 8 square miles are much more than important probably than 8 of my square miles, but nonetheless, we have a lot of space. The last two pages is to show you, and I draw your attention to this little white area here, and that is the Christmas Valley solar array being put in. And then the last page is going up above it. If you look carefully, you can see that same little white array right above the R in Oregon. And the point here is that that is just a small fraction of the space in my district. And so when we're talking about a square mile, I have 29,000. And so this is not to say that one isn't important as another, but there are a lot of them. So how much money we spend trying to sort out whether or not we can use or put solar in place needs to be taken into account in light of the sheer amount of space we have. And one last remark, after we're finished with Representative Bailey's committee this afternoon, I'll hop in my car and drive home. It'll be 2 hours to Bend, and then it'll be 5 more hours to Ontario. So I'll be driving right across this space, 7 hours from where we sit right now. There's all kinds of land in Oregon, and we need to be using it for the kind of purposes that this bill would allow. And again, this is just a meager attempt to try to show that we have a lot of space, and I'd sure like to see us using it better. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I might actually ask my colleague a question here. I don't see the bike lanes on here. Do they show up in this map, Representative? I don't see them.
Yes, that's right there.
All the beer pubs are in his, though.
You've got some nice ones in Ontario.
Bike sweeps on their pickup trucks.
Oh, yep. Okay. Questions for the Land Use Committee? It's pretty entertaining, this session. We had a bill 2 days ago that nobody came in favor of at all, and 6 opposed.
You must be used to that, Mr. Chair.
It's good. It's good.
It's the chair.
Okay, questions for these two nice gentlemen. Okay. Let's find what kind of bomb you dropped on us by looking at the opposition list. Oh, looks pretty good, actually. Not that bad. Okay.
Thank you.
I think we can move forward on this bill. We have another representative in a little while on another bill, so let's move for a while on this until Representative Parrish joins us. So, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Glenn Montgomery, and Todd Odo. I know you have a last name. I can't quite read it. You're Todd Odo now. Thank you. For your information.
We're out of control.
You could object, but yes. It's not going to do any good. General?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department. And we're here today to testify in support of House Bill 2020A, and specifically to Representative Bence's comments about Christmas Valley, which I should have brought a picture, but it looks like he already did. So we have, you may recall, several years ago, the Air Force had set up what was known as a backscatter radar site outside of Christmas Valley. There's about 2,600 acres that were excluded from the BLM and to the Department of Defense. The site was put in, it was tested, it sat there for 20 years and never was turned on. In order to run that thing, the Air Force contracted and put in a 115 megawatt pipeline or electricity line to run that particular radar. We sought the land when it became, through the base realignment and closure process, it was accessed by the Air Force. We actually went after the land for a training purpose. Right above that particular spot on the map, we actually train our F-15 fighter pilots out of Klamath Falls, and this site offered a very unique opportunity for us to actually put emitters out there, so when these student pilots are training to fly an F-15, we could actually use remote sensing to send up electronics to force them to do certain actions, like, for instance, simulate a SAM missile strike or launch at them, or anti-aircraft, or whatever that case may be. So that was our primary purpose for getting this particular site. It also had on it three major large buildings that we asked for to be excluded out of that 2,600 acres, about 320 acres, that had these three big warehouse buildings on it that the Air Force had put in for that operation, to use that as a means of storing supplies, bulk supplies, in the event of a Cascadia earthquake or something like that. We can store things down there. We can fly in there with helicopters, get it, and move it to the coast where it won't be involved involved in any Cascadia 9.0 earthquake. So that was the other reason that we took advantage of it. After we studied the site and realized what potential it could have, we recognized that it had 115 megawatt pipeline coming in there. We said, well, why don't we look at some other means of generating electricity on that site? Primarily, the reason we're doing that is the Department of Defense has launched a program called the Net Zero Program, where they want all the DOD agencies to go to net zero if they can possibly do it, because of the cost and the amount of energy that's used. We were the only National Guard state in the country to be selected into this program, in this pilot program. And so we are working forward on that on many different fronts, wind, water, wave, and solar. To this particular bill, what it does for us is allows us to actually start working that direction with a reasonable amount of land that's already been committed. It's been developed, or a good portion of it has, and it's on very arid ground. It's basically sagebrush. And the other advantage of this site is that all of the environmental efforts and the historical efforts have already been done and redone a second time when we acquired it. So it's a very unique piece of property, and we're very, very pleased to have it for multiple reasons. This, like I said, this bill, we estimate that it takes about 80 acres for 10 megawatts of solar. And so 640, we would prefer to see it 850, but 640 is a good start. So we are in support of the bill. Wrap it up, and I'll be happy to take any questions you may have.
Let's go ahead and go through, if you can stay time-wise.
Yes,
yeah. Glenn?
Representative Clem, Chair Clem, and committee members, my name is Glenn Montgomery. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. So I represent the trade group that has members such as Solar World and other manufacturers, residential and commercial installers, and everything in between. I'm here to support House Bill 2820A, and I was active in the working group, not from the inception, which was, as Representative Jules Bailey said, about 2 years ago, the inception of that group. But I began working with it shortly thereafter. And the process, although at times arduous, resulted in a pretty successful outcome. Although we didn't reach complete consensus on this issue of jurisdictional control, it was a compromise that almost everybody felt was a reasonable one. And Representative Benz and Representative Bailey kind of stole my thunder in terms of the testimony I had. Much of what they said, I was going to say. One of the things that Representative
Benz... That's what we do,
yeah,
if we can.
Apparently.
Yeah.
So, and the fact is, I'm going by memory because my testimony is sitting in my laptop on my desk. In my haste to get down here, I brought my adapter, but I forgot the laptop, and I couldn't extract it out of the adapter. So I'll submit that tomorrow or when I get back to the office. But the fact of the matter is, we have a report coming out that's called The Vision to Integrate Solar in Oregon. This report identifies a vision over the next 20 years of what is possible in Oregon. And we envision an energy supply in which we could provide 20% of Oregon's energy using solar. It's quite possible, technically. And it is possible if we have the political will and if we create policy that allows us to do it. That 20%, which, by the way, we have less than 0.001% currently today, that 20% represents about 6,000 megawatts of capacity for solar. 6,000 megawatts requires about 65 square miles. You heard Representative Benz. Now, he said he had 29,000 square miles. I think he's got about 9,900 square miles. At least that's what the web tells me. But I think he might have been talking kilometers, because it's about 26,000 kilometers. So the fact of the matter is, he's got a big area of land. Lake County has 8,000 square miles. 65 square miles is what we would need to do 20% of Oregon's energy supply. So what that says is there's a lot of land and a lot of opportunity for growth. The 640 acres was a compromise. It's something that we could really see some scale. Scale drives down cost, and that's one of the biggest detractors for solar today, is that it still costs more than some other technologies. If we can, we have a huge opportunity right now, and if we can take advantage of that through this enabling legislation, we will take a big step towards achieving that greater vision. And I'll leave it at that.
Todd.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Cornett. Not Todd Odo.
I'm the siting division administrator for the Oregon Department of Energy. Uh-oh. Although maybe I'll go by Todd Odo in the future. We'll see.
You want to.
So my intent is to give you some context and background as to why the bill is written the way it is. And I'm going to start with the handout that you have in front of you. There are two types of solar facilities. One is concentrating solar and one is solar PV. So the first picture you have is a concentrating solar facility. So I'm just going to read through what it says. It's a system that uses mirrors or lenses to concentrate a large area of sunlight or solar thermal energy onto a small area. Electrical power is produced when concentrated light is converted to heat, which drives a heat engine connected to an electrical power generator. There's not a lot of interest so far that we've heard about this type of facility in Oregon. And so you see the way this function is, in addition to the footprint impact, there's also a kind of day-to-day facility. It's a turbine engine, and there's employees, and there's infrastructure associated with that. So it has a more day-to-day operational impact than the photovoltaic facility, and that's on the second page. So these are the type that you're typically going to see, and I think these gentlemen have been talking about. So it's a method of generating electrical power by converting solar radiation into direct current electricity using semiconductors that exhibit the photovoltaic effect. So really, this is just a footprint impact. Once it's established, and it can be a large footprint, once it's established, it's a fairly benign use. There's some limited amount of operation and maintenance, but not like the other type of facility. And it makes sense to understand the differences between these two because as I go forward and describe kind of the elements of the bill, it really, I think, will help you understand that. So as Representative Bailey talked about, there was a work group that was established, and really the intent of that work group was to evaluate the issue that we are confronted with today. The Energy Facility Siting Council statute, ORS 469-300-11, is the definition of energy facilities. So that acts as the jurisdictional threshold for when a facility goes from a county or a city to the Energy Facility Siting Council. So there are currently two solar citing jurisdictional thresholds. One in subsection D, and you can read that in the bill, is it's a 100-acre threshold. So that is anywhere from 10 to 20 megawatts. And the reason why there's a wide range in megawatts is because not every location has the same kind of solar profile. So some will be less and some will be more, and so that's the range. That 100-acre threshold was established in 1975. The other threshold is in subsection J, and that is what's referred to as the 105 megawatt threshold. In actuality, it's listed as a 35 megawatt threshold. 35 megawatts is the average generating capacity. Solar is determined to have about a 30% efficiency, or 33% efficiency, meaning it's only working about 30% of the time. So the 105 megawatts would be what the nameplate capacity. If the facility is working 100% of the time, what would the size of that facility need to be? And that's why it's referred to as the 105 megawatt, because it's actually the nameplate capacity. At 105 megawatts, you're looking at about anywhere between 525 to 1,000 acres, to give you a sense of what the scale is. So that was established in 1991 originally, had a 25 megawatt threshold. At that time, there was no change to the 100-acre threshold. In 2001, it was changed to its current 35 megawatt average threshold. And again, no change to the 100-acre threshold. Well, because of the way the language is written, there is no clarification as to was one intended to be for concentrating solar or was one intended to be for solar photovoltaic, and there's no case law and there's no legislative intent to give direction as to that. What happens is effectively the 100-acre threshold is the threshold for solar today. You would never reach 105 megawatts because that at the low end would be about 500 acres, and so you're always going to be at the 100-acre threshold right now. And so, as you've heard discussed, if there is a desire to have larger scale solar facilities in Oregon to be reviewed at the local level, this is going to need to be fixed. And so that was what the working group that Representative Bailey talked about. So that group was broadly representative, had quite a few folks on it, I think, to have all interests associated with solar siting. And as you already heard, there was general consensus on many, many things that came out of that. And so I'm just going to kind of go down and describe what those were. So first of all, there was consensus that the thresholds for solar photovoltaic and solar concentrating facilities should be different. And so in the bill, those are separated. So now you have, under subsection A, you have solar concentrating facility is put along with other thermal facilities. Again, going back to the day-to-day operation of that facility, functions more like a natural gas plant. So everybody was generally in agreement that that was a good place to put that. You have under subsection D is reserved exclusively for solar photovoltaic, and subsection J, the solar reference was removed entirely. There was also consensus that an acreage threshold was the appropriate threshold for solar photovoltaic because, again, that's a footprint impact, and once that's established, it's fairly benign. And so that's what you have in the bill. There was general consensus that the major impact on where we're looking at these larger scale facilities would be on exclusive farm use zone ground. And so the impact that was mostly focused on was productive farmland. So that's why you see it broken down, in that the threshold's broken down into high value farmland. And there's a statutory definition that's also included in your handout. It's on page 3 if you're interested in seeing what that is, because that's not in the bill. There is a acreage threshold for arable lands. There's a new definition for that in the bill. And there is a acreage threshold for non-arable lands. And there's also a definition, a new definition for that in the bill. There was general consensus that for arable and high-value farmland, that should remain at what the current threshold is, which is 100 acres. That's what's in the bill. There was also consensus that on the non-arable land, the acreage threshold should be based upon how land is utilized, where these will largely or more likely go, which is eastern Oregon, southeastern Oregon. And so as Representative Bailey and Benz talked about, that's, we were looking at sections. So a section is a mile by a mile or 640 acres, and so that's where we were looking at kind of basing the acreage of non-arable lands on. That's where we reached the point where there wasn't consensus, which is what that acreage threshold should be on non-arable lands. So the last straw man that we had during that working group was 320 acres. So that was, you know, half of a section. There was not consensus on that, but that's sort of where it ended. And so now you see in the bill, you have a 640-acre threshold, which is an entire section. So it is worth noting, the Energy Facility Siting Council process is a significant, robust process. It involves a lot of evaluation. It's probably important to note that because of the statutory requirements in the exclusive farm use zone, which is where these would likely go, at the local level, you're still, the counties would still review these as a conditional use. There still would be a Goal 3 exception required at anything over 250 acres, and there's still the DLCD solar siting regulations. So it's not as if the review process would be insignificant if it was done at the local level. It's a different kind of magnitude of review that's done at the Energy Facility Siting Council. So that's what we have there in the bill, and that pretty much outlines kind of where we got. There are two elements that I'd like to bring up, so two potential amendments to the bill that I would like to include, and those are on the last two pages, I believe, of the amendment of the handout. One is related to decommissioning. So because we didn't talk about the size that's in the bill at the working group, concern is that there's no mandatory requirement for decommissioning at these higher acreage levels. So at some point, every facility has a life cycle and will need to be removed. So in the Energy Facility Siting Council process, there is a mandate every single facility that's reviewed and approved has a decommissioning requirement, has a financial assurance, a bond or letter of credit associated with that that has to be maintained to ensure that should the facility cease working, that the citizens of the state of Oregon are not required to pay for the cost of decommissioning that facility and removing it. So the DLCD's solar siting rules actually have a decommissioning standard. It's in there, it's referenced, but it's permissive, it's not mandatory. So at a mile by a mile, or 640 acres, our concern is there should be at some point a decommissioning requirement. What that point is, I don't know. I'm certainly not prepared to talk about that today. So our request would be to direct DLCD to establish a work group to evaluate that rule and come up with a mandatory decommissioning requirement at an appropriate acreage, whatever that is, and kind of an appropriate financial assurance bond or letter of credit. Again, not knowing exactly what that is, but I think a work group could help establish that. And then the other issue, which we believe requires an amendment, is under the solar photovoltaic jurisdictional thresholds, the 100 acres and the 640, the discussion at the work group was entirely based upon farmland. There was no discussion on other zoned lands, commercial, industrial, non-resource, that just wasn't discussed. And so right now, the way the statutes are written, they don't talk about farm productivity. It's simply what's the threshold before you have to go to the Energy Facility Siting Council. Our concern is the way these are written is at 640 acres on non-arable lands, we believe that residential land would be considered non-arable, commercial land would be considered non-arable, industrial land would be considered non-arable. So in at least some of those zones, certainly the impact of a 600 and potentially 640 acre solar facility is pretty significant in a industrial or a commercial zone or a residential zone. So we don't think that 640 should be the actual acreage threshold before it comes to the Energy Facility Siting Council. So the proposal, which is on the last page, talks about an amendment to Section D, which would include a 100-acre threshold for all non-exclusive farm use zone lands, and then include exclusive farm use zones for the other thresholds to be clear as to what their intent was. So with that, I will conclude my testimony and entertain any questions you may have.
Okay, questions for this panel? Representative Holby.
I'm not sure if this is for this panel. I was trying to remember a different bill on a different day, and on page 3 of this land, it refers to a tract of land, and I was curious if we had a definition of what a tract is.
That was the one nobody showed up to testify in support of, I think. So, or maybe that's the other one that we did get, just, Mr. Freshwater.
Well, while you're looking for amendments, maybe you can get us a definition of that.
Okay. Will anybody know about that on this bill? Track the land. We'll work on that with Mr. Morrissey here in a little bit when he comes up. Could have used you the other day, probably, on that one. Okay. So this one for now. Okay. Well, you've escaped fairly easily for the moment. Didn't go too far, but we have one of our colleagues on another bill that
she'll be coming about 5 minutes.
In about 5 minutes. So what I'm going to do is do the few work sessions we've got here to explain to people what's going on so they can leave and not have to sit here for the rest of it. So let me just temporarily recess the hearing on House Bill 2820A. Bear with us, sorry. We're having a work group on the aggregate issue, and...
You got to open, then you get the work group.
I just recessed on one bill. I didn't recess the committee. So now that we're I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2202. We're having a work group on the aggregate issue, people. And it's going to include Representative Cameron Davis, myself, Rich Angstrom, one of his board members, Mike Dewey, Katie Fass, one of her legal team and a board member, and staff from Dogami and the Department of Agriculture. Any questions about that? Yeah, Representative Holby.
Ms. Chair, are you actually working the bill or passing the bill?
No, we just wanted to have a, instead of rumors, we wanted to have a public, as soon as we get the tape rolling, public
announcement. There's going to be no motion
announcement.
On the bill.
No motions today. Okay, just announcing so people know, and then they can leave.
Oh, we could just move it.
Yeah. Okay. So... That's any questions about sort of process?
You mentioned also a Ways and Means referral.
Sorry.
Chair, a Ways and Means referral.
Yes, I did not mention that in the second part here. There's a fiscal on the bill. I didn't know that. It didn't have a subsequent referral. If by the time the work group's done, nothing really changes, we're still going to have to add a technical motion to the subsequent referral. The Speaker's office has already stamped it and said it has to go there. We have to actually do that by motion, apparently. So that's the plan on that. Any questions, comments from my team here? It's on the work group with me. Okay.
We're recording it this time, so we're in good shape.
I close the work session on House Bill 2202. So those nice people can leave. Now let's see if we can get rid of all the annexation people. Let me open work sessions on House Bill 2028, 2617, and 2618. Now this one, we're working on the what I like to call the hostage annexation, which is House Bill 2028. Remember, we've had a list sent around to all of you of things that you might, if you're a city, provide. And I'm working on which things you're allowed to hostage people over with your non-remonstrance agreement during that process. And so what I asked... The amendment to look like was rather than what you can't hostage people or what you I'm trying to get a list of the things you're allowed to hostage people over when they come in to get services. And so right now the amendments that at least I've put forward, we talked about the other day, are the things that you could make someone sign a non-remonstrance agreements in exchange for allowing them access to these services by the city. The discussion we had earlier was maybe start their other direction. I prefer this way. So for those of you who don't want to be on the list, you should really come in the next week or so and ask to be let off and explain why to committee members. For example, where's Beth from the Municipal Electric? She showed up yesterday and made the case that they provide infrastructure. It costs a lot of money. They aren't necessarily doing it, but they should be off the list. So she's in the amendment to come off the list. If you want off the list, then you should come and talk to people. Otherwise, at some point, we're going to run out of time here. And given I know the league would like us to just limit it down to building permits only, and I don't want to do that, this is the other way I'd prefer to go, is hear from committee members or people who are involved in this issue what things you think you should be able to hostage my constituents over when they come and talk to you, just to put a frame on it for everyone. Any questions on those?
No.
Great. Good. Let's close the work sessions on the... Erin's been fantastic working. Not sure she's going to agree on anything, but she's very helpful, and I don't mean to give her a hard time. Let me close the work sessions on House Bills 2028, 2617, and 2618. I don't think those are going to be done by Tuesday. In fact, we're not going to meet at all Tuesday because we're largely out of bills for public hearing, and we're just now working on bills.
That might be an excellent time for our work group. Uh-huh.
That's right. That's a good point. Last but not least, and then we're going to go to Representative Parrish, who's patiently waiting, is let me open a work session on House Bill 3125. This is, colleagues, you might recall the bill about when the He's here. When the large timber landowner is selling off property that has a house on it, they would like to keep the timber in production but get the house out of their possession, and we're trying to get to the least, to the kind of minimum size for that, and we have some amendments. The amendments are what are they called?
Dash twos
are up. They basically are things that have been worked out with all the interested parties. We can have someone come up and explain them if you desire. The part I asked is that make it clear that that no new dwellings can be created by this, that this is an existing dwelling, and that any of the new land use units, tract, whatever we're going to call them, that are created parcels don't allow for a new dwelling. This is to dispose of an existing dwelling. And that was probably not necessary according to LC, but restated anyway, just to make sure. If anybody's interested, I could bring up proponents real quickly.
I'd like to hear about the amendments.
Okay. So why don't we wait for a moment on that and get, unless she is okay. Keith, can you come on?
Keith up here.
You opened a work session.
Yeah.
On 3125.
Yes. So these are the dash twos. And then maybe, who was my other, was Thousands and Friends working on these amendments?
Yes.
No?
Yes.
Okay. So tell us about the amendments, if you could, the dash twos.
Chair Klim, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Heath Curtis with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. To be clear here, the remedy that we had proposed and discussed with the committee last time is not altered by the dash two amendments. The dash two amendments, I believe, were prompted by a request from the chair, and as he indicated, our read of the dash two amendments is that they make no substantive change to the current text of the statute. You'll note that there's quite a bit of this bill. There's kind of minor modifications throughout. It's actually better drafting as amended, and we would support them. The dash one amendments we thought could arguably create a substantive change, and though we weren't actually terribly concerned about it, we thought it would be best to avoid any substantive changes so that there would be no new opposition or involvement on the bill. So all of that said, the only change from the dash two amendments, you'll note if you have in front of you a copy of the original House Bill 3125 that Section 2, little b, large b, provides that the dwelling existed prior to June 1st, 1995. That's line 21 of page 1. This has merely been moved up into the text of little b. That is to say, it makes more prominent the requirement that the dwelling existed prior to 1995, but from our view does not change substantively what the law said previously. So in that light, we view the dash twos as immaterial and would again urge your support of the bill as amended by the chair.
Any questions?
Not to open up a can of worms, Chair.
Yeah, Representative Davis.
Because it was already in the statute. What's the policy behind the date for the dwelling being 1995? Do we know? It's obviously a historical reference thrown in there somewhere.
Yeah, so Chair Klim, Representative Davis, I don't know. I would say that at the time that this was put in place, I believe, in fact, I don't have the actual statute in front of me, but I believe it coincides with the time when this carve-out was originally made. That is to say, the way the land use statutes are set up, they kind of say, here's your minimum lot size, and here are circumstances under which you can establish minimum lots that are smaller than those. And so I believe 1995 was when this exception, this carve-out to the minimum lot size was actually created. But I'm kind of speculating. I don't have it in front of me right now.
Back of the room.
And so that said, again, from our perspective, it's what the statute says presently, and that's not being modified.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Okay. Yes, please. Can you move the chair's immaterial amendments?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the immaterial dash twos. No, the dash twos are material. Your dash ones were immaterial. I'll move the dash twos to House Bill 3125.
Thank you, Vice Chair Cameron. Vice Chair Cameron moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3125. Any discussion? Any objection? Amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 3125 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Cameron moves House Bill 3125 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Holby.
Mr. Chair, was there any opposition to?
No, we had some discussions with 1,000 Friends and the department, and they didn't, I don't think, actually testify in opposition the first time anyway, but they are good with the dash 2s or the original bill.
Thank you.
They're just my amendments, and I wanted them, and so probably nobody but me cared, Representative Holby. So, anyway.
I find your amendments very material.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Excellent amendments.
You're already on the work group. You don't need to.
Right. Okay. Any further discussion? Yeah, you can't get off the work group now. Sorry.
Nice try, John.
I'm not.
Okay. Well, clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye. Excuse.
Representative Unger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cameron.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Aye.
Chair Clem.
I'm an aye. And with that, Bill number 5 from this committee makes it to the House floor. House Bill 3125.
Huge.
Okay. Now, let's get to...
Do we need a carrier on that?
Yes, we do.
I'll carry it.
Yeah, Representative Davis.
All right.
Thank you. Let's get to Representative Parrish, who's here to talk to us about House Bill 3384, and then for the energy folks, we'll return to that in a little while. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Parrish from House District 37. And the bill that you have in front of you today, and I don't know if you've been provided the diagrams here that we brought for your committee. The bill that we bring, I know, gives some folks heartburn around siting and land use, and I'm just going to own it. I don't purport to be a land use expert. That's not what I ran for the legislature to come do, but I have amazingly found myself now on 3 land use bills in my community because it is so complicated, and particularly given for those of us who kind of live out at the fringe of the metro area, a lot of discussion about what land is going to be for and what the communities are supposed to look like. And I guess I'll just start this by saying, you know, I appreciate that land use planning is really designed around, and people who are really trying to be thoughtful about it are doing so in mind with things like, you know, houses and transportation and school placement and, you know, where are you going to live, work, and shop and play in your community. And as somebody who I think lives in a fantastic community and a community that's done a really good job about that, although, again, we're going to start engaging in some really difficult conversations in parts of my district here in the years to come about expansions of Stafford and different parts of land. One of the things that I don't think land use planning does, or if it does, it's not doing enough of, is thinking about the other types of needs, societal needs, that might arise from a variety of situations. And in this particular circumstance, the societal need that I'm talking about is how we handle and treat and care for veterans who have served our nation. And in this particular war on terror post 9/11, we have sent hundreds of thousands of soldiers across the United States. 2% of the United States is shouldering the burden of a 12-year long war, longest wars in our nation's history. And from that, the need that you will hear if you come and ever have the pleasure to come sit in the Veterans Affairs Committee, the need is high for health care, mental health care services, programs, and making sure that we get people back into reintegrating into their communities. I will say that the deployment that my husband served on with the Oregon National Guard in 2009-10, that group came home to a 50%, nearly 50% unemployment rate. It was the largest deployment to of our Oregon National Guard soldiers since World War II. That cohort, 3 years later, is still 20% unemployed, so higher than the state's national average. Suicide ranks as the, in 2012, suicide was the cause more deaths than combat deaths in our country. And so as we start to think about land use and planning, we're going to have to start thinking long-term about how we care for a new generation of veterans who've experienced war in such a way that our Vietnam veterans, who were not treated well when they came home, they've experienced this war very differently. And so a thoughtful land use planning needs to start looking at some of the societal needs that are not just about housing and schools and bike paths and grocery stores. So House Bill 3384 is being brought to you, and a lot of bills, like, you know, usually arise from one situation, but the bill was written in such a way that we hope it would cover more of these situations. Brought to you because there is an opportunity right now, it has been actually an opportunity for the last 8 years, to engage in a public-private partnership opportunity to create a 51-acre veterans complex north of Wilsonville in unincorporated Washington County. So if you're driving up I-5 and you get to the Rasmussen Mercedes dealership, the wooded area right next to that starts that parcel. You've got a diagram, hopefully, in front of you with a schematic of kind of what they're envisioning that complex to look like. This is somebody who's willing to gift 51 acres of very high-value land for a common cause, societal good, good of the order type of a project. The project in and of itself has the opportunity to create quite a few jobs with the building and the layout and the work that would need to be done, both in infrastructure jobs and construction jobs, and then long-term jobs of people who would staff and take care of that facility so that veterans could live and work and shop and play in a community designed to take care of them. There's not a facility in the nation that exists like this. It has the support of some very high-dollar, high-recognition-named donors in our state who are willing to come forward and do this because they feel it's part of their civic obligation to take care of our veterans. And the challenge here, colleagues, is a land use snag, and I appreciate that this body does not like to do land use law for one side or another, so we tried to write this bill in such a way that it would apply to anybody who would like to gift land for the purpose of veterans, and frankly, I'd be happy to extend it to people who want to gift land for children's hospitals and a whole slew of other things that I think are for the common good. Now, there's going to be a whole bunch of folks behind us who come and testify about why this doesn't work and local control, and we heard a bill in the last legislative session, House Bill 4090, where a lot of those same players came and crabbed about local control and not being able to be involved in the state kind of superseding. And these types of projects that we're talking about are really not, we're not asking to do things like this for some big development company that's going to get rich and that's going to build McMansions or, you know, condos or high-rises or whatever. We're talking about the care of people who, whether we agree with why we send people to war or not, we're talking about the care of people who have cared for our nation and the ability of us to start to think long-term solutions of how we incorporate these people who, you know, have challenges back into our communities. So I appreciate that, you know, you've got letters today from folks like Metro, House Bill 3384 selects one of these uses and exempts the local planning process, and communities consider competing needs and costs of meeting those needs. We had a work group, small, quick meeting this morning around this, brought some of the stakeholders together, and in that discussion, the city of Wilsonville, who is not a fan of this project in the way that that I'm a fan of this project, mentioned the fact that in their 20, 30-year planning, that this parcel of land is not really in their plan at all. So if you don't have a plan for it, you know, let's talk about how we make sure that somebody else who has a valid plan for that can do that. Now, one of their long-term plans that is not necessarily for the use of the land would require some things like eminent domain to basically take over that piece of land to put a road there. I would argue that for the common cause, a veterans establishment that would serve thousands of veterans potentially in our metro community, probably a little bit better than landing a road right in property and taking somebody's property to do that through the eminent domain process. There are some others here as well who you're probably going to hear from who are protest the bill and don't care for the bill. Thousand Friends of Oregon. A little quick note about one of the things that they're talking about. Their concern, these types of facilities should be located where they are accessible by transit or walking. If you notice, there is a transit diagram on the map. This area is served right now. Currently, the areas surrounding it are adjacent to the Wilsonville Smart Transportation and to TriMet. And, of course, all of the communities in my House District pay quite a bit of money to support TriMet, and we would certainly like to see more rate of return on that, and would love to see TriMet come down and service this facility should we are able to get that built. And so there are going to be people who have a lot of reasons about why we can't do something, and we hear no a lot in this building, and veterans in this building hear no disproportionately, I think, in the few years that I've been here to any other group who comes to the legislature and asks for something. We do really good feel-good things like Veterans Days off and urge Congress to give more money, but when it comes to writing the checks, we don't do a good job, and this one doesn't require us colleagues to write a check. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Rick Peters, who is here to speak on behalf of the landowner and to tell you just a little bit more about the project and why we think this is a good bill.
Thank you, Representative Parrish. My name is Rick Peters. I'm president of the Oregon Veterans Foundation. And good afternoon, Chairman Clem, Vice Chairs Frederick and Cameron, and members of the committee. It was 8 years ago that we were here doing the very same thing. And I'd like to just give you a very brief outline of how this started. My wife and I have been putting on and sponsoring veterans events and activities for well over a decade. The last one that we did, a big one that we did out at George Fox College back in, as a matter of fact, 10 years this year, Veterans Day time frame. It was a great event, but we wanted to be able to do more, something that was long-lasting. And so many sleepless nights later and began to have discussions with director level and above at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, as well as ODVA, Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, both Jim Willis and then Paula Brown. Both are now, of course, retired and gone and replaced by new personnel. But we have a pretty full staff of very fine folks, competent folks, and decision makers within their respective fields. What we wanted to do was to bring together a number of resources to benefit all of our at least Oregon's veterans, but most likely it would reach across the river as well. And some of those activities, we know that, for instance, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs loves to have the community-based outpatient clinics, or CBOCs, as well as other healthcare facilities, whether it's skilled nursing facilities or veterans benefits processing, other kinds of things that we know that ODVA, Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, really likes and would like to see more of are not only skilled nursing facilities for veterans, but also housing and other assisted kinds of living facilities. We can accommodate those by simply providing the real estate all in one location. We don't need to do what they already know how to do. But what a boon it is for the veterans who have to come from a variety of areas to be able to come all in one location, including getting their benefits processed. For those of you that are veterans that have had to go through that, right now it's slower than it's been in a long time. It's approximately 9 months.
13.
Just 13. Well, I stand corrected already.
Right now.
So, thank you. And it's that's not an indictment on the VA, whether federal or state or whatever. It is not that. It means that there are a lot of folks coming back that need help. Oftentimes, services are farmed out to the private sector anyway. And that's something that most of us don't realize. All we're trying to do is not only pull the services that are already provided by both federal and state entities, but also where we come in as a nonprofit charity is simply, well, what can we do to make this a place not to just park mom and dad, thank you, brother and sister, for your service, see you later. What can we do that would be memorable? What could we do that's maybe one of a kind, but what would matter? And one of the things that we found out in our discussions with the various groups, including the veterans themselves, was that having all of these facilities in one location, in addition to things like sports and rec facility that we already know Wilsonville would dearly love, well, what's the problem? We can build that. Oftentimes, and I believe Representative Parrish is very accurate in this, you're going to hear why it can't be done, why this doesn't work because it's not in the master plan that. And I say, well, there's always a provision. There's always an escape out of that, even in the metro level. I say, well, we can do this. Why don't you let us? That's where we come from. The monetary part of it is nothing. And I can assure you, when the time comes, should the committee desire that, the $150 million I expect this will run each one of these individuals that's interested in our project could write the check personally. I certainly wouldn't ask them to do that. But we have the financing and the backing to pull this off. What we really need is a change in venue. The problem is not the project. And I want to be the first to admit, even the city of Wilsonville does not object to our concept, only the property in question. And the reason being is it's outside of the urban growth boundary. Well, why can't we pull it in? That's our problem, okay? So I guess where I'm trying to come with this is, what can we do that is different? In other words, we're not just trying to build another Fred Meyer that took Wilsonville 20 years to, or I should say it took Fred Meyer 20 years to build their store within the limits of Wilsonville. What can we do that is institutional in nature? Does this matter to the city of Wilsonville? Does this matter to Clackamas County? Does this matter to Metro? We know that no matter how much the federal monies are placed towards it, as you know, with this so-called sequestration, that's an unknown, and how much dollars, cents may or may not be available.
About one more minute.
Absolutely. So really what we're asking here is some open minds, some open hearts, but a willingness to help the men and women who've served this country. And they're being very well taken care of, but when they come home, there's cracks, and that's all we're trying to do is fill a void. Thank you.
The last thing I'll just add quickly, and I know we're on a schedule. One of the concerns of the city of Wilsonville is related to the so the cursory city analysis showed $14 million in water and wastewater improvements need to be developed right there. Many of you know that I am working very diligently on HDR 29, the Oregon Veterans Lottery Bill, which we intend to get to the ballot one way or the other. And since I'm not, LC says I'm not employed, I've got my petition right here if anybody wants to sign it, although most of you on the committee are already on the bill, so thank you. And a quick check with the treasurer's office said that the fact of it is to reach that $14 million, and I bumped it up to 20 because things cost money, would require $2.5 million a biennium bonded against that lottery if that was specifically available for veterans. And the way that lottery resolution is written would certainly allow for, because we're talking about housing, health care, mental health, all of those things, everything that this site wants to do could be an appropriate ask to come to the legislature to help bond for the capacity to do the infrastructure piece under HDR 29 should it pass on the ballot in November 2014. So I'm certainly committed to helping the city of Wilsonville in any way, shape, or form find the infrastructure dollars needed to commit to this project. So I will certainly share that with that. And to the point about how fast we are processing veterans, we have veterans right now who are dying, waiting to be served by the Department of Veterans Affairs, and that is really not for the lack of caring at the Department of Veterans Affairs. But, you know, many of you know my husband retired last year. We are 13 months into the processing of benefits just to check the disability rating and then the things related to service in the Gulf. And now imagine being a 40-Vietnam veteran who is just accessing the VA for the first time and you're on a list. We know that our Vietnam veterans are dying at a faster clip than, or just about as fast a clip as our World War II veterans. So the ability to put more of this into communities is really going to be critical moving forward as we start to learn how we're going to care for our post-9/11 veterans. So with that, I will take questions or hop up there and let the rest of the hearing keep moving.
Any questions for these two? We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 more on this bill, and then we'll go back. For the other folks on the other bill, I'd say about 4:30, if you want to go get a drink of water or coffee, you got 25 minutes, if that helps the energy folks. Any questions? Representative Holby.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your efforts on this. I'm curious. I'm not sure if I caught it, but what's the zoning on this land right now?
Urban reserve, I understand it. So we're not affecting farmland or critters or, you know, some of the things people get worried about land use, so.
Urban reserve. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now let's have... Mark, is it Otentad? Otentad. From the city of Wilsonville, Aaron from the League of Oregon Cities, who's had to deal with my harassment for several weeks, so I'll be very nice to her, and Mike Eliason from the AOC. Keep it to 5 minutes or less, that'd be good. Hi, welcome.
Good day, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chairs, members of the committee. Mark Otnett, Public Affairs Director for the City of Wilsonville, appearing on behalf of Wilsonville Mayor Knapp and the City Council. There's two bits of testimony that are being distributed now. One is the formal prepared in advance testimony that speaks towards the larger issues, the city's opposition to bills that result in state supersiding of land uses and preempt local control as a primary issue. And then there's another set of handouts pertaining to the specific site. And what I'll do here, first of all, say is that we've known Rick and Elizabeth Peters for many years and have talked about this property and this concept for some time. The city is very concerned with veterans issues, and we share that concern. We work actually very closely with the Korean War Veterans of America Association and the Oregon Korean War Memorial Foundation to support Veterans Affairs in Wilsonville. And we do support existing programs for veterans and recognize that they could be strengthened. However, we would respectfully disagree that this particular land use bill is the appropriate method to proceed, that veterans issues and land use issues are not necessarily the same. The bill deprives local government of self-governing autonomy by preempting our local land uses and superseding a particular use. Our Planning Commission, which is a citizen body, has conducted multiple looks at this area, including a 20-year look required by state law, as well as during the Metro Urban Rural Reserves process, which was a 50-year lookout. And in that look, the Planning Commission determined that the areas north of Wilsonville were not needed by the community or the metro region within that 20-year purview. And that furthermore, this specific site has a number of unique issues dealing with it. And I don't know if the handout has made it around here with the some of the colored maps. But the city did work with Tualatin, Washington County, Metro, and ODOT on the Basalt Creek Transportation Refinement Plan, starting on page 6 of the attachment. And this refinement plan was designed for the urbanization of the Basalt Creek and Coffee Creek areas and the Southwest Quadrant Concept Plan and the East Sherwood area to provide access for industrial traffic and other urbanization needs. If you jump then to the last set of pages, 15 and 16, these illustrate where proposed roadways would cross the subject property, which is outlined in a green border. And in essence, there's been a number of local area, metro, county processes that have been underway for many years looking at urbanization for this area. Areas around Wilsonville include the Coffee Creek and Basalt Creek areas, which are over 1,000 acres for industrial land. And then immediately east of the city is the Frog Pond UGB area, as well as at another area, the Advanced Road area. which is an urban reserve also. And these are areas that the community, through the metro planning process, has identified for the highest level of growth for the community for both long-term employment, industrial jobs, as well as for residential use. And then related to the site, too, is issues of infrastructure. This particular site, unfortunately, is the furthest away from our water treatment plant, our wastewater treatment plant, and our stormwater infrastructure. As a hillside with a steep hillside with shallow bedrock, it will require a great deal of excavation and explosives to develop the site, and then it will shed a fair amount of water. And so ODOT controls the right-of-way extensively along I-5, and is fairly particular about the granting of surface water runoff. Additionally, from the city's perspective, our infrastructure in terms of our pipes, our water, and our wastewater pipes immediately below the hill are undersized for servicing further up. We can go up to the Costco Argyle Square Shopping Center, but after that, there's very little capacity. So this is why in August 2010, our Community Development Department prepared a staff report for the City Council and other members of the community looking at some of the logistical issues pertaining to this particular site and identified, as Representative Parrish indicated, at least $14 million, but that was a ballpark cursory view of infrastructure improvements that would be needed, and that could be more. And that did not take into account the fact that a subsequent planning process would overlay a new major set of roads from the Basalt Creek planning process onto that particular site. The city is also in the process now of completing our TSP, Transportation Systems Plan update, and it too did not take into account a state facility or development of this particular area. I think those are some of the core issues of consideration. Again, the city does support Veterans Affairs. We'd be happy to continue working with the representative, with Rick Peters, with Korean War Veterans, and we have a new organization that we've worked to form called the Korean War Memorial Foundation. It involves members of the Korean American community who want to step up to the plate and help American veterans who serve in Korea both during the Korean War and subsequently. And so we would be happy, because there are other places within the city limits that do have urban services that we'd be happy to see about having a facility like this developed.
Thanks.
Chair Klein, members of the committee, for the record, Erin Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. I'll be as brief as possible. Our problem with this bill is that local land use decisions should remain local and shouldn't be turned over to the state to make these decisions for local communities. We understand what it takes to plan out the infrastructure. We're required to plan out the infrastructure, to pay for the infrastructure, to extend the infrastructure, to service, to maintain. And if land use decisions don't take those into account, we can't properly plan and do the rest of the things necessary to serve the citizens of the city already. So our basic stance is local control for local land use. And while we do support our veterans in any way that we can, we don't think this is the right solution for this particular problem. Thanks, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. I'll also be brief and not repeat, hopefully, my colleague Aaron's comments. But basically, I was not familiar with the local issue until several days ago, but my interest was more in the breadth of the language of the bill, which speaks to basically superseding, in general, statewide policy for these types of facilities. And again, you know, sympathetic to anybody who has trouble getting a project off the ground. We'd like to see every good project serving good people get off the ground. But in general, I would say that most folks, most communities probably would be actually, with all due respect to Department of Land Conservation and Development, would probably be more eager to work with their local jurisdiction than turn things over to land use planning over to the state for their own community's purposes. So I'd also note that it seems to be that the language in the bill seems to suggest that there would be no way to deny a permit if it went through the state under these circumstances. I'm not sure if that was the intent or not, but in general, we have an issue with supersiting, and we would be opposed to this bill as it's written right now. Thanks.
Okay, questions for these three? Thank you. We're back on schedule. Mr. Honeycutt and Mr. Leo, you two know each other. Let's just come up together. Kumbaya, except you're on opposite sides of this bill. So that'll be good. Okay. Old land use warriors here.
I go first, Greg?
Well, I will. For the record, this is Greg Leo for the city of Wilsonville, and I just wanted to remind the committee the difficulties that we've had with supersiding in the past, and particularly the 1990 supersiding of the Coffee Creek Prison in Wilsonville, which, you know, led to work with this legislature for 4 years of back and forth and a lot of wear and tear on our community. So I wanted to echo what my colleagues have said here today about the problems with supersiding, and that land use works generally well in Wilsonville. It's a very workable city that's popular. A lot of people want to come to Wilsonville. Maybe that's the issue here today. The city of Wilsonville does support veterans, and this is an interesting project in a lot of ways, and one that we hope to have a continuing dialogue with the promoters and with Representative Parrish. Thank you.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. Speaking in support of this bill, we've had a brief local control love fest in the last few minutes. We kind of lost that argument. We're very much in favor of local control, but we kind of lost that argument in 1973. So,
it's kind of regional something going on down
south.
Yeah.
Representative Parrish has identified a problem. There's a piece of property in Wilsonville that can provide a solution to that problem. It's a problem that we very much support finding a solution for, so we're very much in support of this bill, although we normally don't support supersiding bills either because of the unique nature of this and the particular issue that Representative Parrish has raised. This is one that we think makes good sense.
Okay, questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Just a clarifying point.
Yeah. Representative Davis.
Is this property within the city of Wilsonville?
No.
It is not. It is a urban reserve that is contiguous to the northern boundary of the city of Wilsonville.
Okay. I find it interesting that the city of Wilsonville has sent two individuals up to testify in this bill today that were property not within its city boundaries.
Yes, Representative Davis, Chair Clem, this bill doesn't even mention the city of Wilsonville. In reading this bill, it's about supersiding and about any city in Oregon, really. So in our conference this morning, when we discussed it with the sponsor of the bill, this specific site came up. So that's why we're talking about the city of Wilsonville and a specific site adjacent to it today.
I'd be happy to have you look at the map, and almost a little piece of this property touches Tualatin. It's separated by an I-5, but I'd be happy to have it come into my house district fully and support that concept of bringing it there. The city of Wilsonville doesn't particularly want to work with this project, but I appreciate the concerns of the local control piece. I have another land use bill that hopefully will come before this committee. And the interesting thing here is it's a really horrible issue that's happening on the other side of my house district, where the community hates what's going on, and yet the permitted, the land use laws are so crazy in our state that it actually allows for this really awful project to happen right in the middle of Stafford. So here you've got a different situation where, actually, I've talked to quite a few citizens in Wilsonville who were not aware this is part of any planning process. Who say this is a good idea, but the law precludes us from doing it. And over, 2 miles away, the law allows us for a really heinous project that my community hates. And it's perfectly legal, acceptable use of land. So it's a bigger problem of land use laws, I think, in Oregon. I don't, again, purport to be an expert in them. But it seems a little crazy that if I were just to flip the, flip the problems or the situations and move one to the other, that I'd have a zone where I could do this project if the land was just sited 2 miles away. But I can't do it. We can't do a project like this
going 2 miles the other direction.
Thank you, Representative Parrish. Anything else? I was going to try and poach this project for Salem because I'd like to get my dad, who's a veteran, going, but I won't try that.
Do you have somebody in Salem who's willing to have 51 miles of 51 acres of land that they're willing to give for free to that project?
Do we? Pixweet, maybe?
Anyway,
I don't
want to
poach your bill. Nope.
Meritorious project. Sorry, in many ways.
Yeah, don't want to poach your bill. Sorry about that.
Thank you.
We like veterans here. Okay. Thank you. With that, that's all I've got on my little list here, and I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3384. Come out of recess on the public hearing on House Bill 2820A. I may have been wrong on the time, so let me see what I can do here. Michael Morrissey, David Brown, and Varner Seaman? Seaman?
Yeah, he's outside. I'll go.
Okay. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, okay. The union guys are going on break.
Yeah, they are.
Back to the super saving of the electrical.
Yeah, now we're
back. This is super committee today.
Super power.
Well, yeah.
I'm sorry.
No problem. I said 4:30. I lied to you.
I think it's wrong.
I'd rather admit I lied than was wrong. That's terrible. And the other gentleman, we'll just, once you two start, we'll wait for the other two gentlemen. So, Michael, do you want to go first?
Thank you for saving me from running back down the other way to get in the carpool, but right. I think right now this works out.
We're good.
So
okay. Mr. Brown.
Go first, and then I'll jump in.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Brown. My company is Obsidian Renewables, and we are a solar developer here in Oregon. We have developed or co-developed the two largest projects so far in Oregon, one for Pacific Power, one for PGE, and we are eager to let everyone know that we think we have more projects under development. I've been part of the discussion on land use bill for seems like about 4 years now. There have been the committees, as Representative Bailey and Representative Bence described. I am here to testify in favor of House Bill 2820, and I got a request, Chair Clem, through Brian Doherty, and asked me if I could talk to DLCD, Mr. Morrissey here, and with Thousand Friends, Steve McCoy, and see if we could understand where we thought the bill needed to be tweaked and reach as much agreement as possible. From those conversations, three items were identified. One is the use of the term non-arable land. As Todd Cornett, Todd ODOE, described here earlier in this hearing, the focus of the work group was always on agricultural land. It started as a Goal 3 exception work group dealing with agricultural land, Goal 5 when wildlife got blended into it, and then at the end the question of FSEC jurisdiction got added, but the focus had always been on agricultural land. And so I agree that the idea wasn't to not have a cap that applied to non-resource land or to industrial land, and it would be my view that that cap would be the 640 acres. I was surprised to hear Todd testify today that he's suggesting 100. That just hasn't been discussed. With respect to residential, that'd be fine because you can't afford to put solar on residential. The cost benefit of that would just never ever work. It would never work on industrial land unless it was a brownfield. And I've been working on this long enough to be sensitive that you're going to FSEC means that the cities and the counties don't have jurisdiction to make the decision anymore. And if we're going to interfere with reuse of a brownfield, I think it would generate a lot more discussion than we've previously had. But it just really hadn't come up in the work group. Second, there was a question that Mr. Morrissey had for me about wildlife review. ODFNW was part of working out the wildlife review that would occur, and a rule was adopted defining that would occur at 250 acres. Now we have a rule about 640 acres, and the question was, would the same wildlife review occur? And that is our intention. I think it can be handled by rule, so I don't think the bill needs to be tweaked, but maybe one of those statement of legislative intents would be useful. Then the third question was size, the number of acres. I very much support the 640 acres. As Mr. Cornett explained, current law has 105 megawatts, which is, depending on your technology, between 500 and maybe even 1,000 acres. Current law also has 100 acres, which I believe applies to solar collecting, but there is an ambiguity about that, and I thought that 640 acres for grazing land and 100 acres for cropland was a good compromise and a good resolution on that point. So that's my testimony, and thank you very much.
Great. Michael.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'm Michael Morrissey. I'm a policy staff with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I want to say that the department and the commission have both been involved with, especially the House Energy and Environment Committee, on solar siting for the last couple of sessions. And in fact, the commission was asked to change one of its standards and did that at the request of that committee last year, and then has been asked again, and that's a pending request to the commission from the chairs of the House Energy and Environment Committee from last year to change some further provisions with regard to recommendations that came out of this working group that you've heard about that relate to how wildlife is handled. So there's been a kind of an ongoing and continuing link between that committee and the commission. I want to say I did testify on the earlier version of this bill, which you heard was in an earlier version. The relating clause didn't work, and I was asked what our position was at that time. The recommendation was coming out of those work groups. The acreage threshold for FSEC was 320 acres, and there were some other issues, including the work request that went over to the commission, and I basically said we were fine with all of that. When the bill got moved into its new form, we did not testify. I actually just didn't catch it, and so the two items I want to relate now I haven't been able to relate earlier, so I hope there's an opportunity to address these. I want to say that there's two hydraulics at work on this bill. One is when FSEC takes jurisdiction and does a siting, and that discussion before you is somewhere between 320 or perhaps 640 acres. Below that, a county's going to process it. The other threshold is what's called taking an exception. And if FSEC gets it, it's above the rule that the commission set for an exception, 250 acres. FSEC will still go through the exceptions process, which is pretty well defined. When the threshold got raised...
Sorry, repeat that last sentence.
Sure.
The exceptions process.
Well, so FSEC, to my understanding, will use the exceptions process that is under the commission's jurisdiction land use rules and statute that says basically why you have to do this here and not do it there and what you've got to take into exception. They wouldn't be using our rule at that point because our rule is only going to apply to when a county looks at something up to 100 acres or up to, up to 250 acres on rangeland. I'm sorry if that's not quite clear, but so at any rate, one of these is who's going to do it, and the question is what rules are they going to follow? When the House Energy and Environment Committee raised that threshold to 640 acres, it created what I've referred to as a donut hole. Under the rule that the commission did, when a county's going to do it, generally speaking, there are wildlife provisions that say, what do you do if you find out there's some conflicts with wildlife? And ODFNW is allowed to bring contemporary data to the table to be considered by the county. When FSEC handles a process, they also have a separate authority to bring all state agencies to the table with contemporary data. If this threshold gets raised to 250 acres, a county could be processing something where they will be stuck with, and you may know this, Chair Clem, and some of the rest of you will know this, old Goal 5 inventoried data. So one of the two concerns that I've been trying to bring is to try to find a way when a county does a process under the FSEC threshold that they can allow more recent contemporary data about where habitat and species may be threatened. So that's that issue. The other issue has to do with when the commission did its rulemaking on solar siting, and it's got this designation of land called non-arable. It's still a type of EFU land, but it's the least best. Typically, it's grazing land. There's a definition in our rule for what non-arable land is. The definition in the bill is slightly different, and I've suggested to some, if we're going to use that term, then I'd like to see that the definition be the same.
How long has your non-arable definition been around, and was it only for these purposes?
It was only for these purposes.
Yeah.
There may be another non-arable somewhere, but to the best of my knowledge, non-arable lands is for the purpose of solar siting. And basically, it's not land that hasn't been used as cropland.
It was one of the things that made me a little bit curious, at least, if not nervous, because I'm used to seeing more soil types, which in here, I think we then define it almost as is somewhere in there. I think there's some soil type references, too.
Part of.
And
yes.
So when I see something that says non-arable means not can't be used for agriculture, which is more like the dictionary definition, and then I see class 4 and 5, think about all these wineries that are currently on that kind of soil, and that's what made me nervous, that I don't want non-arable incorrect definitions for actual real ag land use purposes to start flowing over into the land use statutes because of just the need to get a division here on solar.
Chair Clement, committee, the whole purpose of this solar siting was to incentivize solar development at a commercial scale to go on the least good lands.
Right. Yeah.
And if it's a type of farmland, the least good is what the committee and the commission approved as this definition of non-arable. The piece that's left out in the bill that is in the rule has to do with whether or not it's been irrigated within a certain period of time. So there's a way, I believe, to not use the term, and I think one of your subsequent speakers will suggest that. But if it is used, we'd like there to be the same language. It's just going to cause confusion. So I think that's it. So we have a wildlife concern and a definitional concern, and we'd like to hope there's not too hard a way to find a solution.
And just one other question. This particular exceptions process, is it different than what, for example, Young Life said they could never do? Sorry to ask. But,
yeah, Chair Clem and committee, there's basically a couple different types of exceptions process. One is what's called for built and committed. It's land that's essentially developed and it's not really farmland, so you get to say why that's the case. This would be what's called a reasons exception, and basically it's why something has to be here. Why can't we go on to less good land? It has been used for a wide variety of purposes in cities and counties. I think the general impression that you get from people who come and approach you is essentially it can't be done or it's too lengthy, and I believe the solar folks have some reasons why they believe exceptions takes a long time and why FSEC takes a long time. So people are looking for something that will save them some time, but the exceptions process is a viable process, and it's there to be used.
Okay. I'm sorry. Are you Varner? Yeah. Why don't you go ahead, and then we'll do questions for all three of you.
Yeah. Chairman Clem, members of the committee, my name is Varner Seaman. I'm the policy director at Renewable Northwest Project. Here, basically speaking in support of this bill, you have to forgive me if I can't speak to the same level of depth in terms of Oregon's land use planning process. The way that we look at this bill is that there's been, and I think that as folks have been talking about the work group process that's occurred and about this bill in particular, there was quite a bit of work that took place in in the work group process, dealing with a number of different definitions. As we look at this bill, we view this as being essentially more providing flexibility to developers in terms of being able to go through either a county or the FSEC permitting process. And we want to stress to folks that by going through a county process, they still have to deal with Oregon's land use laws. There isn't, as we view it, it isn't sort of a get out of jail free card, and that there still is a permit that folks have to obtain. And that, as folks have talked about the bill, I think that from our perspective, developers still have to go through a permitting process, and that it isn't. While it does give some flexibility, it doesn't necessarily guarantee that these projects would be built or that they wouldn't go through what would be robust scrutiny. So in the interest of improving flexibility, we're speaking in support of the bill today. Thank you.
Any questions for these three?
Sure, I'll ask one.
Thank you, Chair Klein.
As far as the size of these sites go, what right now the bill says 640 acres. Or do we have any sites that are that big currently? And then are there any proposed to be that big?
Chair Klein, Representative Unger, members of the committee, David Brown of the Obsidian Renewables. Oregon's largest solar project is 5 megawatts AC, and it occupies approximately 44 acres. It's on a 60-acre parcel. The military site at Christmas Valley has a request in for transmission that would be 20 megawatts, and a project that size would occupy about 160 acres. I think the general testified that they have approximately 2,600 acres at that site, but that a significant amount of it is dedicated for military uses. I think that the next projects being built are likely to be 10 megawatts in size, so double the current largest, and they would occupy approximately 80 acres. I have two building permits to build projects of that size. The ideal size for economies of scale is significantly bigger than what we're talking about, but there's not a lot of demand right now for electric energy because there's plenty of energy in the system. We've had another adequate water year, and so there'll be plenty of hydro again, and there's just not a lot of demand for electricity. As the economy recovers, as things pick up, and especially with the coming of data centers, the demand for electricity is expected to increase. Apple Computer, which is under construction in Prineville, has confirmed their commitment to renewable energy. They built 40 megawatts of solar in North Carolina. North Carolina solar resource is weaker than Oregon's. If they would build 40 megawatts of solar near Prineville, that would take about 300 acres. Facebook is also right there, and you might think that someone would build a project capable of serving both. That would start to raise some issues with Pacific Core's ability to take that much power because it's kind of an isolated island for Pacific Power, but together that would probably get to the FSEC jurisdictional threshold. There is some technical language about when projects are considered aggregated for FSEC jurisdiction purposes, and that's a subject that's under continuing discussion with FSEC about how they want to write that rule. So I don't think we're going to see a project that big in the next couple of years, but it is possible. I do think we're going to see more solar than we have, and I think the projects are going to continue towards getting larger. Somewhat interesting to me, the largest solar project in the world is under construction by the parent company of Pacific Power, which is owned by Warren Buffett. You may have heard of him. I think he plays guitar. But anyway, so that's Jimmy.
Yeah, that's
it. Anyway, that's down in California. It's on private property. It's 567 megawatts. That's about 4,000 acres. And when they pull up a map of that project, there are three other projects over 200 megawatts in the immediate proximity, which is right on the edge of the Mojave Desert. Of course, that project at that size went through an extensive California state review process.
So if I might, just to, you know, Michael, you talked about this, the two hydraulics. I think it's still hard for me to get it stuck in my head. So when we're talking about a project, like in the bill, it says 320 or 640, that's not the project size that would be allowed. That's if someone proposed a project of 500 acres, if in the bill right now it's at 640 and someone proposed a 500 acres for review, they would still go to the local jurisdiction?
So, Chair Clem,
yeah.
Two things, and to make this pretty simple, and I want to clarify, we're not against the bill, we're neutral on the bill. Actually, after all this time, I'd like to see this thing resolved and have a happy ending. So I want to be clear about that, too. Representative Parrish's site is a perfect example of when you might take an exception for it. What Representative Parrish is saying is, evidently, given where the site is, I don't know much about it, but this thing has to be here. The current land use program doesn't normally allow it to be here, but we have all these reasons we want to tell you why it has to be here and not there, and why you could compare this to other sites and you would come to the best conclusion it should be here. So we want an exception to Goal 3. We want an exception to the land use program for farmland. Uh-huh. That's the basic concept. Analysis against other sites, so why can't you go over there and why it should be here. Secondly, your committee chair or your committee administrator has a shorthand one-page version that our staff did that you could all look at that just gives you the basic concept of what an exception is there for and how it works. And I would suggest you look at it. Thirdly, the commission rule says over 250 acres of a site on rangeland, whoever, whether it's FSEC that gets the authority to handle this permit or whether it's a county, they must go through the exceptions process.
So, okay, let me, sorry.
Yeah, uh-huh.
So, if someone wants to propose a 500-acre site, possible. This bill has nothing to do with that, really. It's who do they make that application to. This bill's only about
who they make the application to.
They can propose a 20,000-acre site if they want to. It's who do they make the application to.
That's
the county through exceptions or FSEC through exceptions. And we're trying to pick a limit to which entity they go to.
The FSEC jurisdictional threshold, that's right.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, as I understand this, and having worked for 3.5 years for a developer, some developers would choose, this is, and I think that it's probably clearer to say the threshold at which it must be an FSEC jurisdictional, because up to that range, the developers have the ability to choose. The gentleman to my left may choose to go through FSEC, he may choose to go through a county permit on a 500-megawatt project. There are different reasons why different developers would make different decisions, and there are a number of different factors that go in. There are different strategies that go into permitting.
Okay.
An FSEC permit, there are different things that FSEC can do that a county cannot do. Some folks think an FSEC permit could be more defensible down the road. So I think what we're talking about here is up to that threshold, people get that discretion.
Okay, that's helpful to me at least. We've got two more speakers I think could illuminate the conversation. Thank you, Mr. Brown. I at least want to have more solar in Oregon. I want your company to do well. We'll see what we can do to figure something out here.
Thank you, Chair.
I think most people like solar, mostly, you know, general.
Thank you.
Maybe not the subsidies so much, but okay. So, could I get Joe Esmond and Steve McCoy up here?
You could just say a nice simple thing.
We were in recess. I didn't say anything. Joe and Steve.
Happy cooler. Twins separated at birth.
Joe, you're first.
What's bald head guy goes first? Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Esmond, IBW Local 48. I do the politics and the renewable energy.
Yeah.
I'm probably the only licensed electrician in this building. So when the General Caldwell called those transmission lines a pipeline, I had to correct them. I was a little nervous, but I corrected them. And anyway, I have a lot of the reason you're sitting here is because of me and Representative Huffman, but more me. About a year or so ago, a couple years ago, in the Energy Committee, threw a fit. Wasn't proud of it, but I did it out of frustration. And I'll tell you why. Oregon has great land use laws, great solar resources on the other side of the mountains. Originally, my nickname from the bill was Solar Rocks. Let's put it on non-arable land, as arable as this. How about the small farmer, the small rancher, which over there is it could be 8,000 acres, but yeah, a little bit more income for that person, not unlike the windmills, which is their best crop. So there's more solar in the Garden State of New Jersey, which is hard to believe, being from Pennsylvania, than there is here. So I'm trying to push for this, okay? And you have to forgive me here, I'm a little tired. I want you to know there's roughly 15 solar-rated manufacturing firms here in Oregon. The biggest solar world down to, say, a small five-person shop making little components. They employ roughly 1,500 people, and I think this would help them out without a doubt. It would be nice to use Oregon products, American-made products, on these jobs. I mean, on these solar arrays. I want to address the fact of what happens when the resource is done. Well, you put the structure up, the panels get out of date, boom, 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 you change them out. Okay, I want to give you an example of what almost a megawatt would be on a flat roof. Visualize a football field. Okay, that's a flat roof, no roads, no anything else. So just want to give you a visual. So you do, for 1 megawatt, it employs four full-time people. I was partners with Mr. Brown, or my contractors and our workers, to do those two projects down by Lakeview County. Our union has trained over 2,000 people in solar. We see it as another part of our what we do. And by the way, that didn't cost the state or government any money. That came out of our. I'm paying right now $1.50 an hour to go into our fund for apprenticeships. So I know I'm wandering. I think the only laws I know about real well are the electrical code laws. So I'm not going to debate ins and outs. But I think this would be a great bill. 640 acres doesn't seem unreasonable. Even though I take umbrage at Representative Bence's comment on West Virginia, having lived there for 4.5 years. So we're in support. I will, and I'll take any questions after you're done, I'm sure.
Okay,
thank you.
Steve.
Thank you, Mr. Esmond. Thank you, Chair Klim, members of the committee. I am Steve McCoy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I am here talking about this bill because, I'll be very brief, as usual, because we've submitted written testimony on it, seeking amendments to the bill. The written testimony chronicles the history of both LCDC's rule on when an exception needs to be taken, as well as kind of a very long history also of energy facility siting council jurisdiction. And again, I think it kind of came up in the last panel, but please note that neither of these thresholds is a bar to producing solar energy, to building out a site. Both of them are merely whenever you've consumed so much acreage that more process is necessary to make sure that what you're doing is appropriate. So there's a practical problem with the bill that was discussed by various folks, and I talk about that in my testimony, that it's possible that some lands will be neither arable nor non-arable, and therefore would never come under FSAC jurisdiction. And I think there are actually also farmlands that could happen with. And I provide an example in my testimony. So in our testimony, we make the point that in eastern Oregon, it's not a barren wasteland devoid of agriculture. In fact, three of the top five grossing counties for agricultural products are in eastern Oregon. Six of the top eight grossing agricultural commodities have a very significant nexus with eastern Oregon. We need to protect agriculture in eastern Oregon. That is the economic driver in that part of the state. I'd also like to point out that wind and solar are different. We have been very supportive of wind energy in the past. You can still ranch, you can still farm underneath wind turbines. You cannot do commercial farming practically under solar arrays. So solar and wind are different. So we urge you to fix the practical problem that exists with the bill. We also urge you to bring the threshold down to 320 to protect agriculture in eastern Oregon. Thank you.
Questions?
Joseph.
You got a question?
No.
Representative Esmond.
Watch what you wish for. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just want to remind this committee of land use. From my understanding, there are 8 to 10 counties on this side of the mountains that or might have serious financial problems. And for better or worse, we don't need that. This will help supply some money to those counties on the other side of the mountains, which is the highest solar, the best solar resources in the country. It's higher elevation. You don't have hot nights, 300 days of sunshine. It's hard to put solar, make it efficient. And 30% efficiency is not the efficiency rating. I think there's some that information is outdated. But the hot sun really hurts the efficiency. So it's good. Besides the job, somebody's got to live in a motel. Somebody's got to go to a restaurant. Representative Cameron, and buy supplies and gasoline and everything else. So it's a little boost for those areas, and they hire locally. So
I had a question.
Thank you.
You just mentioned something that prompted me. Something I was saying about in my office when I was talking with Todd about this. Is there anything in the rules or this bill that talk about Eastern Oregon placement versus Western Oregon placement?
It was my idea with Representative Huffman, who I hesitated to speak for.
Yeah.
It was Solar Rocks. He brought it up to me a couple of years ago for his people, his jurisdiction over there. Helped it. You know, it was never my intention or the intent of me, you know, to do anything in Willamette Valley. One, the solar resources are not as good as over there.
Yeah, right.
Plus the farmland.
Yeah, right.
You know, I got to eat too. So
that eight pears, chairs,
pears and chairs.
Chairs.
Okay.
Or I have a few apples left.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Klan, members of the committee, no. There is nothing in this bill that cabins it just to Eastern Oregon. I think when there's discussion about it being cabined to Eastern Oregon, the discussion is around the definition of non-owable lands and saying, well, gosh, we don't have a whole lot of those on the west side. The non-owable lands do include class 5 soils, so those are pretty good soils.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic because I understand this bill is about the place at which it's reviewed and not so much the land use size and policy, but you are in the land use committee, and so I am interested a little bit in at some point, even if it's not through this bill, ensuring that we aren't squandering the opportunities in Eastern Oregon and also not squandering the opportunities for food production, other things in the west side. Sounded to me from my conversation in the office like just economically not likely to happen anyway. Just not likely to happen, not enough sun, that kind of thing. But we artificially try and keep the price of farmland low by limiting its use for other things. And so I do get nervous at some point. Becomes economical And then we have another one of our fights we currently have around here over landfills and aggregate and everything else in farmland. So to the extent that we are able to avoid that by promoting Eastern Oregon solar, sounds like a great idea, you know, from my standpoint. I know that's not really what this bill's about. It's about review and who's doing it. And I've been everybody from their three-day weekend. So you can finish us off, Joe.
Very quickly, we wouldn't have gotten this far if we hadn't talked to the Farm Bureau and Sean Van Cleve up a couple years ago.
Sean Cleve. Yeah.
Sean Cleve. Yeah.
Okay.
Like the Van Cleve.
Yeah. Van Cleve.
I'm giving him an honor. Yeah. But,
Mr. Chair, that was,
he said, you know, nothing in the valley, fine, let's go over there. And here we are today, and hopefully we can find the resolutions and put people to work, can buy some goods. Thank you.
Meet the various mandates I voted for in the past.
Okay. All right.
And with that, let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2820A and adjourn the Land Use Committee and enjoy your in-district days, ladies and gentlemen. And we'll not see anybody here on Tuesday because we're not meeting Tuesday.
We are meeting for the
work group.
We have just.
Okay.
I think pretty much agreed.
Adjourn the Land Use Committee.
70 degrees outside.